My introduction. It is Thursday, November 15, 2007. This is Leanne Diakoff, and I am interviewing Alvin Lehman Martin, who was born June 23, 1924. He served in World War II in the Army Air Forces, attaining the rank of technical sergeant, and he served in the European theater. This interview is primarily regarding Mr. Martin's World War II service. Mr. Martin, I'll just start out by asking you to tell me a little bit about yourself before the war, where you were born, and a little bit about your family.
I was born the date you mentioned in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, and in 1928, 4 years of age, I moved to Glasgow, and that Glasgow, Kentucky, has been my home ever since. And I was one of eight children. I had five brothers and two sisters. And all of my brothers are gone now, and there were three of us out of the eight of six that were in the service. And two sisters, myself, are the remaining ones of the family. My father's name was Benjamin Harrison Martin, and everyone called him Benny. My mother's name was Hattie, and they were both originally from Hardin County, Kentucky, Rineyville, and Eastview. My dad was a stonemason. By that I mean he littered monuments. Well, he sold monuments. And he went to work in Glasgow at 28. And after that, he started a business of his own just outside of Glasgow city limits called the Economy Monument Company. And so we lived there from 28 till 43 when I went into service. And it's a wonderful community and good neighbors. I can't remember for sure, but I think I was in church when I first heard about the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And I was just, 16, I think, at the time, and 41, or 17, yeah. And I don't know what caused me to think about going on into service, but May the 22nd, 42, I graduated from high school in Glasgow. June the 23rd was my 18th birthday, and the law that caused the 18-year-olds to first register for the Army was put into effect June the 30th of 42. So it caught me by 7 days. Anyway, I registered, and I think it was about November or December. I thought the draft board was going to call two of my friends, and they were about a year older than I was, and I thought they'd be going in the next month. So I went to the draft board and volunteered. I told them to call me. And they called me in the next bunch in early February. But my two friends didn't go into service until a year later. So I was by myself. But they eventually went to China Burma India Theater, and I'm glad I didn't go over that way. I'm glad I went to Europe.
Now, what were some of the advantages that you perceived by going ahead and just enlisting on your own?
Advantages? Mm-hmm. I don't know if except maybe the interviewers saw that I wanted the Air Force. I was begging them for the Air Force because I wanted to be a pilot more than anything. And I later found out that I was partially colorblind, so that disqualified me from pilot training. So then I started asking them to, please let me get in the Air Force. I want to fly. But I was sworn in to the Army here in Louisville on February the 9th in 43. And then a week later, the 16th, me and 30 others of the fellows in the Barron County area, we left and went to Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana for our induction center and processing. And we were there about a week, and I got acquainted with KP, if you know what that means. Mm-hmm. Kitchen police or kitchen patrol, whatever. Anyway, they really worked you at that. I learned to peel potatoes, and I learned the KP, and the mess sergeant even had me in another bed washing the floor with a cake of soap and a brush. And I made the mistake when we got it just about finished. I said, they must be going to eat on this floor tonight, as clean as we're getting it. And I didn't notice. Miss Sergeant was standing right behind me, but he said, they are soldiers, is going to eat here, so you do it again. Clean the floor again. It was already. So I learned to kind of watch one before I talk too much. But
had you ever done any work like that before?
Oh, yes. Up, yes, sure. I had some. I had a mother that taught us her sons, how to handle some kitchen and chores around the house, and I'm glad she did.
What was your mother's reaction to your enlistment?
I don't remember. If they didn't oppose it, and I don't remember a time my mother or dad opposed it and told me they wished I wouldn't go. And I guess I was one of those smart 18-year-olds that knew everything. And I knew there was a possibility of seeing a lot of the world, and I wanted to do that. And I did get to see quite a bit. And but they never opposed it, and so I left on the 16th and went to Fort Bend. And all my aptitude tests turned out pretty good, or at least for my benefit. And me out of those 31 men that went up there with me, 30 men, two of us went to the Air Force, just two. The rest went to infantry field artillery up in Oregon, or Washington one. But we went to St. Petersburg, Florida, and those two, and we were billeted in the Serena Hotel right on the waterfront in St. Petersburg, Florida. And we didn't stay there but about a month. They taught us how to march and how to handle rifles and some skirmishes and
at the hotel.
We marched out to the edge of town to do that. Mm-hmm. To learn all those things, and then I think it was the 27th of March we got on. I don't know who else, but this friend of mine that was with me that didn't come from Glasgow, he didn't go to the place I did. I don't know where he went, but we went to Florida and trained down there for a month, and then I asked for because I was kind of mechanically inclined, I asked for aerial engineering, flying as an engineer on the plane. And I was hoping to go to Keesler Field, Mississippi. But I didn't. They sent me to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to a radio operator mechanic school. And I was never too much interested in radio. But they taught us how to build a receiver and a transmitter, and then they taught us radio procedure and cue signals that we used to code messages with. And we learned the Morse code, and I liked the Morse code. I was working on about 25 words a minute when I graduated there.
How long were you in Sioux Falls?
In Sioux Falls from March about the 20th till the latter part of August, about three or months or so. Mm. We finished our radio school, and they sent me to Aerial Gunnery School in Laredo, Texas. And that was the most interesting and wonderful part of my part of my service. I loved that gunnery school training because I love to shoot guns. And we shot everything from a BB gun to a 20-millimeter cannon. And that's pistols, 45 pistols, submachine guns. We even shot skeet, and that with 12-gauge shotguns. And that was to teach us to lead targets. You know, when they're moving, you have to lead them, and that's primarily what that was. And then we flew in the AT-6's training planes in the back cockpit, and it had a 30-caliber machine gun there, and then another plane would let out a target, a big sleeve target, and we would, each of us gunners would fire at those targets, and we had painted bullets so we could tell which one hit the white sheet target and all. And then some of the other training was they built wooden planes and set them about a quarter mile apart on the ground, and our pilot would get right down on the top of the trees, and we were to shoot at those planes as they went by, learn to lead and learn to not hit the parts of our plane we're flying in.
Now, but was that the first time you had been in a plane?
I think I'd been up one time at some kind of show in Glasgow earlier than that. I can't remember. It may have been. But I sure loved it. I sure loved to get up in that airplane. And then we finished that in, I can't remember the date now, but it was in September, I think. Yes, September of 43. And then we received a furlough from there. We had 10-day furlough, so I got to come home for the first time and see all my family and friends. Oh, I really enjoyed that.
Tell me about your furlough at home. How did you get there?
They had a special bus, a Greyhound bus, and they picked us, they put us on at I think it was San Antonio, or maybe at Laredo. I can't remember which place we boarded it. But that driver took us all the way through to Nashville. And that was a long ride, day and night. And he really came across them states out there. I mean, he drove it. Then on at Nashville, I had to board another bus for Glasgow. And I don't remember too much of the experiences there, but
During the time when, in 43, was the country rationing things at that time?
I think they were just starting it. I believe so. I never experienced much of that rationing. I never asked my dad and mom. I know I heard them talk about tires for cars and sugar and different things, and mother had mentioned that in letters to me overseas. But I never got experienced much of the rationing or know how it worked.
So when you got home, your mom was still able to cook you a good meal.
Right. Yes. I missed those good meals. And she would make candy sometimes. And I don't remember if she made a cake or not, but she would send it to me overseas. And boy, that was wonderful. But then after the furlough, I was to report Salt Lake City. And I got in there a day early, and I didn't like that. I lost a day. But anyway, they sent me from Salt Lake to Kearns, Utah, about 20 or 30 miles away for a refresher course in radio. And then from that one-week course, then they sent me back to Salt Lake City. And then we were sent out to Boise, Idaho, to meet our bomber crews, the people that were going to be on the same plane with us. And I got to meet, I can't remember. The last one that I got to meet was the one I wanted to become acquainted with first, second. I wanted to know the pilot. And the second one I wanted to know was the navigator, because he and I would work pretty close together, radio and navigation. And finally we met, and I forget, we trained at Boise for about a month, and I forget what kind of training it was. But, well, I don't remember. But anyway, after that month, they shipped us to Fairmont, Nebraska. And there we took some training. Bombardiers were trained quite a bit there. We had a target range up in South Dakota that there was no habitation on the ground, and they had it set up for us, and we bombed. I don't remember if we went to the full altitude, but maybe 10,000 to 12,000 feet, and our bombardier got practice on bombing there. And then they had a gunnery range that our pilot had to fly around, and he'd make all left turns, and we had to fire to the inside, and we got practice firing the 50 caliber machine guns there. And
everyone, even the navigator and the radio operator, and
no, just the see, there was four turrets, mm-hmm. and there's a man in each turret. That's four gunners, and then the radio operator, myself, and the engineer gunner. We had a single 50 caliber machine gun in what's called the waist position of the 24, mm-hmm. and so we had to. We didn't fire the guns out to the right because we'd be firing over habitated country. Mm-hmm. But we trained there for about a month. And then they sent us to Lincoln, Nebraska. And I'm not familiar. They called it swinging the compass. What we did was we'd fly each plane in the compass radio, which is a directional finding radio. We had to calibrate it to make sure they're all correct before we left to go overseas.
Now, all this training that you did from Boise, Idaho on was with your crew,
mm-hmm.
your bombing
crew. Right.
Yep. So, and how many men were in that crew?
There were 10 of us, the two pilots and my pilot I just talked to yesterday. He lives in New York, and the co-pilot lives in Philadelphia. And myself are the only three out of the 10 of us that are living. Mm-hmm. And anyway, a pilot was Peterson from Jamestown, New York. Co-pilot was Robert King from Philadelphia. And then the navigator was Ray Balzerzak from Buffalo, New York. Bombardier was Fred Savage from Wichita, Kansas. The engineer gunner was Ralph Alley from North Carolina, and myself was from Kentucky. The nose gunner was Pat Hagen from Colorado Springs, Colorado. The upper turret gunner was Earl Isaacson from California. The ball turret gunner was Rex Merrill from Missouri. And the tail turret gunner was John Bowling from Charleston, West Virginia. So we were from all over the country. We had John Bowling and then the man, Ralph Alley. I told my whole group one day, I said, we're the most unique plane in the whole Air Force. I said, we got a bowling alley on the they got a kick out of that. But we left Lincoln, Nebraska on the 13th, I think, maybe the 12th, because we stayed one or two nights in West Palm Beach, Florida, before our flight overseas.
And this was what month?
In March.
March of 44?
March of 44. And the morning of March of 15th, we got up around 3:30, I think it was, something like that, had breakfast and were briefed. We weren't allowed to open our orders yet. We didn't know where we were going, but they told us which way to fly. But after we got in the air, we could open the orders and then find out. So we left West Palm Beach, and that was rather a unique experience. And my pilot even asked me today, he said, how can you remember that? My radio desk was right behind the co-pilot, who sits on the right side of the plane. And right in front of my desk, there's a little 8 or 10-inch window that I could see the number 3 engine and the wing. and I can see also the right wheel on the plane. So at 5:32 a.m. on the March of 15th in 44, the wheel of that B-24 left Florida's territory, left the ground. And that was a telling experience for me, because I said quite a good prayer there. I said, "Dear Lord, I hope it's your will that I'll get to see this beautiful terra firma again." And you know, he let me do that. I appreciated that so much, so many times. But the first place we landed was Trinidad, off the coast of South America. And I don't remember any experiences there, but my pilot yesterday told me, "Well, we went swimming at Trinidad." So I didn't go with him, I know. But anyway, we stayed one night, I think, at Trinidad, and then we flew to Belém, Brazil. On the way to Belém, we flew over quite a bit of water, the Atlantic. And the navigator, about halfway through it, he notified me on the intercom, there was a B-17 ditched in the water, had to go down in the water. And he come crawling back from the front of the plane to tell me about it and give me the latitude and longitude. And our radio procedure allowed us, in an emergency, to send plain text messages, plain English. So I sent a message in that the plane was ditched at such and such a latitude and longitude, and they're all in life rafts. And that's the last I heard till I got on to Africa, but they were picked up, they were crewed, so I appreciated that. Later on, my group communications officer kind of gave me a little pat on the shoulder when we got to Tunis and thanked me for sending that message, because they got picked up. And that was kind of nice to get a little commendation from one of the major officers. But anyway, we went on to Belém, and I think we just stayed one night there, but Belém had a pretty important visitor that night. Eleanor Roosevelt was there. And somebody asked me if I was going over and see Eleanor and listen to her speech. I said, "Well, she hasn't sent me an invitation yet. I doubt if I will." Because I was still nervous, and I wanted to stay with my crew, and I had a camera, and we were supposed to not use a camera all the way over, not take pictures for security reasons. But I took a few pictures of different places and didn't let anybody see me. But anyway, I didn't go see Eleanor.
What did you do instead?
I guess I just went to the barracks with by the rest of my crew. Mm-hmm. See, they kept the officers and the enlisted men separate, and there's six of us enlisted men. We went there. We didn't go to town or anything. We just stayed right on the base because we were new at this, and they cautioned us about security and not talking or nothing, letting anybody know where you're going. Anyway, we stayed on. I think we just stayed one night there, and then we flew on south further to Fortaleza, Brazil. And I believe we just stayed there a night and a day. I think we did. Anyway, when we got ready to go across the ocean, they told us, they had us fly at night. And I don't know why they did that, but anyway, we took off at 8 at night. And we landed next morning at 8 o'clock in Dakar, West Africa. And that's about a 2,000-mile flight. And that's a pretty good flight for aircraft back in that days.
About what altitude were you flying?
Oh, we flew, I guess, 5 to 10,000 feet, something like
pretty
that.
Pretty low.
Yeah, we weren't. They didn't want us going up to high altitude. You'd have to use more gas to get up there. We had tanks inside of the bomb bay, the extra gas, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we got over there, and me and the navigator and the two pilots were the only persons awake during that whole flight. And that was an 8-hour flight. And I had a radio called a liaison transmitter. and it was a 1,000-watt transmitter. I could transmit around the world if the weather conditions were all right. But anyway, when I got to North Africa, Dakar, I was still working Brazil with my radio, talking to my codes and everything, and that is kind of interesting. And we had about five or six different types of radios on that plane, and I had to know how to use and maintain them. And anyway, about 8 o'clock the next morning, the navigator came from the front. He crawled through the catwalk back to the pilot's compartment and my compartment. He said, "We ought to be getting in there pretty quick now." I said, "Just about." And boy, we looked outside in just a few minutes, and there's that airstrip at Dakar. That navigator hit us right on. He was good.
What did you think going into Africa?
What
were your impressions going into Africa?
Oh, that was a desolate, that was a bad experience in a way, because people were so destitute and without all the things that we've had in our country, and they felt sorry for them. But we weren't allowed to mix with civilians hardly at all. We had to stay right on our army bases and take care of our business and fraternize with the others. We couldn't do much. Mm-hmm. But from Dakar to Marrakech, French Morocco, was our next flight. And that wasn't anything happened on that. I think it was the other trip. Anyway, we flew to French Morocco to Marrakech. And I think just stayed one night or maybe two. And then we flew clear across the top of Africa to Tunis, right over to the coast, eastern coast. And during that trip, we ran into another plane that took off with us, and his name was Lieutenant Olney. He was a pilot, and I knew his radio man real well because we'd went to school together, a fellow named Yost. And we found out, I guess when we got to Tunis, that his plane didn't make it over one of the mountains. They crashed into a mountain, so they lost a crew going over. My pilot, on the way over, I as I told you before, I could see the wing out there, and the wing has rubber de-icer boots, and the pressure behind it makes them boots work out, and that ice breaks off and flies away. If it doesn't, well, you'd be susceptible to crashing or going down. So I watched that ice breaking ever so often. I said, "Boy, keep that up." But our pilot, he was one of the best. He got us over them mountains, and then we got on to Tunis, North Africa. We were stationed right outside of Tunis at a little town of Oudna. And we were to stay there for about a month because they didn't have our airstrip finished in Italy. So we had to stay there. We flew down over Egypt and practiced, you know, bomb runs and gunnery practice. Mm-hmm. And that kind of got monotonous sitting there. But a few nights after we got there, we're listening to the radio, and I don't know, one of England's big, powerful stations always had some American music. So we were always listening to that. So lo and behold, something broke in on one of the stations. I'm not sure whether it was England stationed or another one, but anyway, Axis Sally's voice came on. She says, "We want to welcome the 485th Bomb Group to the European Theater with Colonel Arnold," knew our commander, and some of the officers. And she says, "We're going to be waiting for you." She says, "You all come on over." Man, we wanted to turn around and go home. That was kind of shocking, but everybody was sure quiet listening to her.
And, that's pretty threatening.
But
how was, when you were here in North Africa, okay, so this was in the spring, early summer of 44, what was the military action in North Africa at that time? Was that still pretty heavy?
No, they had already moved out to Sicily, and they were already invading southern Italy.
Okay, so they had already pushed the forces out north and
pushed Rommel out of North Africa. And no, there wasn't any Germans there left except prisoners. But we flew around there, and they had other people guard our planes. Ethiopian troops would guard our planes, and sometimes they wouldn't let us get close to our planes or didn't want to, because we'd go out to our plane and take care. We really took care of our airplane. Mm-hmm. We put the covers over the engines, you know, to keep the dust and all elements out of our engines, and we kept our plane clean. And we were pretty proud of that. It was made by Henry Ford in Willow Run, Michigan. And by the way, a lot of air crews would paint a picture on, you know, of a lady or something. What was her name? Betty Grable or somebody. And then we didn't want that kind of art on our plane. So we just call it the last three numbers of old 769. Well, that was how we identified our plane. But one of our pilots in our squadron had a brother that was a pilot of a P-38 fighter. And he'd come over some often to just nearly blow the tops off our tents when he come down so low. But it was interesting to see that P-38. They later help us out quite a bit. So it was, I don't remember the date we went into Italy. It was right at the 1st of April, or maybe about the middle of April, I'm not sure, of 44. And if I remember correctly, we could hear the artillery guns of the infantry on up ahead of us. I mean, it's quite a few miles away. And we were about 70 or 80 miles south of Rome. And we were a bomb group all by ourselves at this one air strip at a little town of Venosa, Italy. And we started getting in there, and they had special places for each squadron to park their planes. And I don't remember anything particular about that, but I was always amazed at the pilots, how they could turn them plane, big, great big plane, around on a little revetment and park it where we... It was really interesting. And but we got in there the 1st of April, and we may have flown a couple of missions toward the south of Italy. I can't remember, just to fly down there. But anyway, our first bombing mission in the enemy territory was May the 10th in 44. And the mission was over Yugoslavia, a small town in Yugoslavia that was a kind of a railroad center by the name of Knin, K-N-I, in Yugoslavia. And I remember going in on that, and they briefed us about there might be fighters, but there's going to be anti-aircraft fire against you. And each one of the bomb groups, you see, each group would probably send about 36 planes into the air. That's 360 men, you know, and we'd have 8,000 pounds of bombs. So we went over Knin, and we looked ahead, and we saw another bomb group about 3 or 4 miles ahead of us. They're going over the same target, and we could see the German anti-aircraft fire. They were correcting their fire, and they had them shells bursting right at the level that that other group was. And boy, when you see that anti-aircraft fire exploding, and ain't nothing you could do but just hope it don't hit you. You just have to fly right through it. And I don't remember, we'd start talking about food or something just about time, because the gunners, when you're going right over a target, the fighter planes don't come in because they might get hit by their own anti-aircraft fire. Mm-hmm. So all we do is wait for that bombardier to say, bombs away. And we're talking about this and that. And my pilot one time said, get off of that intercom, you guys. We're in business up here. And so we shut up. And he and the bombardier, we'd start a bomb run at a certain point several miles away from the target, and then that's called the initial point. And then we had to fly a straight line right over that target at a certain altitude. And a few miles before we got to the target, the bombardier was flying the plane. He had control of it, and he's the one that flew it that last until he toggled that switch and dropped those bombs. And we could feel that plane raise up a little when that 6,000 pounds of bombs went out. But sometimes I'd use we had a set of big binoculars, and sometimes I'd use the binoculars and out the hatch or the waist window and watch the bombs go down, and I could tell where they hit at the target, near the target or missed it or what. So I did that. I watched the bombs, and our bombs hit pretty good. I mean, of course, we're about 23,000 feet up. We're almost 5 miles up. You can't detect a whole lot of things on the ground except big buildings and so forth. Mm-hmm. But you could tell if your bombs hit in their designated target. Mm-hmm. And I forget which mission it was now, but it was in June, I think. We took a load of bombs. They were brought up from Africa. They'd been laying down there in the ammunition dumps for several months, no doubt. And they were 100-pound bombs. So they put them in clusters of three. We had a bunch of them bombs in the bomb bay. But they were all tied together in clusters of three. Well, I got ready for the bombardier to give us the sign or to tell us the bomb's away. I got my glasses and got ready to start watching them. And those bombs, to arm the bombs, to get them ready to explode, they had an arming device on there that was controlled by a little propeller. And that once the propeller started hitting the wind, well, it'd start winding itself off of that fuse. And about 300 feet to 400, something like that, below us, I saw all those little propellers fly off of those bombs, and I knew they were armed, and immediately, every one of those bombs all blew up about 300 feet below us. Oh, boy, and it shook our plane. It blew a hole, 6 or 8 inch hole through our number three engine, and that number three engine on a 24 controls a whole hydraulic system all over that. That caused us some problems. But anyway, we couldn't stay up with the bomb group. We had to feather the engine to keep it, from dragging us too much. By that, I mean they feathered a propeller that caused it to set straight with the wind so it wouldn't spin. Mm-hmm. And so my pilot started calling the company commander in another plane and telling him we couldn't keep up and somebody come and help us. And the Germans might come and get us. But nobody came back for a long time. And we started dropping back, and losing altitude.
And where were you, over Yugoslavia again?
No, that time we were over Hungary. Oh. I think we went to Budapest, Hungary that day. It's a big oil refinery we bombed.
So you were quite away from your base in Italy still.
Oh, yeah. We were clear across the Adriatic Sea up in Hungary in the Balkans. And so pretty soon we saw one of the 24s coming back, and it was one of the friends of my pilot that went through cadets with him. And they come back with that, all four of their engines running, and they stuck that left wing of theirs close to our right wing, flew along with us, and it was good to see them turrets with them 50 calibers out there, because some of our turrets were operated by all hydraulics. And we couldn't do much correct shooting without that hydraulic system. But anyway, they flew along with us. And I think somewhere in Yugoslavia or Albania maybe we crossed, we were already down to about 8 or 10,000 feet, something like that. And I'm standing there in my waist window looking out, and I see coming up ahead an oil refinery down there, those big tanks. And before we got to it, I could see the Germans running out to their guns, that 88-millimeter anti-aircraft gun. Whew. Man, the pilot, he didn't make an evasive action. He just kept flying straight. I don't know whether me telling him that caused him to doubt me or what. But anyway, boy, them Germans opened fire on us, and they almost got us. But anyway, I'm the only one except the tail gunner ball turret gunner that could shoot at them. And I'm about 8,000 feet away. So I turned my 50 caliber up and started shooting down at them. And the pilot called back and said, "What are you doing back there?" I said, "Well, them guys are shooting at me. I'm going to shoot at them." He said, "Al, you couldn't hit nothing from this far away." Said, "Let them shoot." But we got over that target without getting shot down. Boy, I was glad. But there was some harrowing experiences, I tell you. So
did they give you a new plane after that, or just did you fix up?
No, our plane got hit a few times, but we kept it until my crew got shot down. But another time, talking about getting hit, the flak would anti-aircraft fire and a shrapnel from it. If it bursts down below you, it goes out this way. But if it bursts up above you, you don't get hit. But I don't know if I was watching the bombs go down or what, but I heard a big, and I'm laying on the floor of the plane looking at the glasses. I heard a big thud, and man, right beside me laid this emergency radio that we had. Each plane had a radio that would send out SOS signals. And you had to put it between your legs and turn the crank on it to generate enough electricity to send out that signal. But I pulled that radio aside, and there was a big piece of shrapnel about as big as my finger and 3 or 4 inches long. From where it was coming through the plane, it was headed right from the side of my head, and that radio stopped it. Yeah, I thanked the Lord again a few times for that. That was, I don't know how many times. I remember quite a few that it got pretty close, and I didn't know if we was going to make it. And then there's no doubt other times that I never knew about it. So I really appreciated being taken care of by a higher power. And there's several instances I've learned of since the war from other crew members, because we meet each year. Now we still meet each year. Our bomb group does, and they tell us some stories. And these history books I got here, they tell about each mission and who got shot and down and who. One of my closest friends on May the 29th, I told you we started our first mission on the 10th of May. On the 29th, one of the planes in my squadron was the first one to get shot down from my bomb group. And the radio man was a close friend of mine. And he just died last month down in Florida. But he got captured, and they were prisoners of war for a while. And I sure did miss him. And then on June 28th and 43, 44 there, we were flying to Bucharest, Romania, and bombing an oil field. And the German fighters hit us that day. They came in from 10 o'clock level. My, it looked like they were right in our formation and meeting us. But I'm firing my 50 caliber, my single 50, out the waist window at them. And then the tail gunner and the top turret gunner, and I guess the ball turret, they were all shooting. And I was kind of halfway listening to all of 50 caliber machine guns in that whole bunch of planes. you fly in a box, they call it, with six planes right close together. And boy, them boys were really firing them 50 calibers at them Germans. And I don't know how many, if we knocked down any of them German fighters or not, but right back on my left was one of my closest buddies again, James R. Scott. And he just died last year in September. He was a real dear friend. His plane got hit as them fighters were coming through, and the smoke started coming out of his number two engine, I think it was. And he started falling back, and we couldn't keep up. And I watched them after they got clear back out of the formation, away from the rest of us, while the German fighters jumped on him, and boy, they shot him all to pieces. And I could see the plane. I quit shooting at the Germans to tell them guys to jump, get out of that plane. Nobody could hear you. but anyway, the plane went on down and down, and finally I saw it nosedive, started, and I thought, oh man, ain't nobody going to get out of that thing now. And just as it started down, I saw two parachutes. And we're still screaming and not shooting and looking at them and hoping them to get out. And this buddy that was a radio man, he started down, and there was an explosion in the plane, and they think it was some of the oxygen tanks or something like that. This is the way he told it to me. And it blew him clear out of the plane. And he's unconscious.
Yeah.
And he starts falling, then he gains his consciousness and looks around and reaches down. He already had his parachute on, luckily. And he pulled his ripcord, and that chute popped open, and it no more had popped open, and his feet hit the ground. Mm-hmm. Oh, my. He described that to me, and he was a physical wreck when he come back. The Russians liberated him after a month or two. But there were some harrowing incidents, and other guys that tell you about the things that happened to them. And on June the 9th, our squadron, well, the whole bomb group went to Munich, and that was a terribly well-defended target. And four of our planes in our own squadron, see, each squadron would send up 8-9 planes. So that's a total of 36 planes from one bomb group. And we lost four of ours. The fighters hit them. I wasn't in the air that day because I'd flown the day before. Usually they let us fly every other day. Sometimes we'd fly every day. But that I was told all about this, and I knew quite a few of the guys that went that day. Four of our planes got shot clear down, and one of them was Flight Officer Lott Waitis. I'll never forget that. His radio man was a Jewish boy, Jack Mizrahi. I was a good friend of his. I was told later that he was told to parachute out, and he froze. He couldn't jump. So three men got out of that plane, and it blew all to pieces. So there's seven men just in smithereens. And then one of the other planes, I guess a fighter come in from the rear, and he killed the tail gunner in the back. One tail gunner got killed. But those three men that got out of that plane in 81 at my reunion here in Louisville, I had those three men here, that was a great experience to see them. But that's 40% of that squadron's fighting ability, with four planes going out of each squadron had 18 planes, and nine would fly one day and usually nine the next day. And so we had to have some replacements to come in, and they did pretty soon. It kept flying replacements in from the States, as we'd lose them, you know. And another friend of mine who I just saw September in Kansas City, Missouri at our reunion, he finished his 50 missions. He was a top turret gunner. And he finished 50 missions and came on home. But I left the squadron before he did that. But anyway, his pilot one day talked about protecting all his guys. And this gunner says, "You protecting us?" He said, "We're the guys that's got the guns. We're protecting you, pilot." But they got it back, all that crew did. And I thought I could remember. I thought I had another item or two in the combat zone. But I can't think of them now. I may come back to that.
You can come back to it if you remember later.
Yeah. Well, anyway, in June, I think, maybe in clear back in May, I developed a cyst on my body, and it kept getting worse, and I couldn't hardly walk for it. And I'd been to the sick call to have it, but all they did was give me some medicine. And so it got so bad in the latter part of June that, or no, it was the 1st of July, July the 8th. Well, I went to the doctor on the 7th, and he said, "Martin, you're going to the hospital tomorrow and get that cyst removed, surgery." So I got up the next morning about 3 o'clock with the crew. They were going on a mission, at my crew, and I bid them all so long. And they left with another radio operator in my place. I'll never forget him. I've never been able to find him. Sergeant E.R. Mack. But they went on that mission, which I missed by just a few hours, and they got shot down over Austria. German anti-aircraft fire knocked them down.
That day?
That very day. So I had told them before they left that morning, I said, "Now you guys come up to the hospital and see me." It wasn't but 10 or 12 miles away, big field hospital. When they didn't come in Sunday, or at least one of them, two of them, I knew something had happened. Well, I just worried to death. And the next morning, Monday morning, my flight surgeon came in from the squadron there, and he said, "Martin, you know you're a lucky guy, don't you?" I said, I know. Something happened. I said, "Did they get out in parachute?" He said, "We counted 10 parachutes." I said, "Praise the Lord." So they all got out, and were prisoners about a year or something like that. And to jump ahead a little bit, that was in 44, July the 8th. And July the 4th in 75, I had 8 of us 10 together in Louisville for a reunion. Oh, they were just thrilled to death.
So everyone made it through the prison camp experience?
Yeah, they made it through the prison camp, and they all lost a whole bunch of weight because they Germans didn't have no food hardly at all.
Did they hold it against you for going into the hospital?
No, they kidded me. You know, I've heard that there used to be times when people in the Army would, when they wanted to get out of something, they'd kind of fake a sick call. So these crew of mine, they're a great bunch of guys. They start kidding me, "That's old sick call Al." I said, "Well, I know when to stay with my friends and when to leave." Oh, boy, I thought of everything after they got shot. I thought of jumping out up there myself somewhere so I could be with them, but that kind of proved silly. I'm not going to, because I'd have gotten tried later for desertion. But those guys had some harrowing experiences. And one of them, or maybe two, I've only got one of them, to tell me about it. But they were in a prison camp up in northern Poland, way up in Poland. And when the Germans were being pushed back west by the Russians, they took all those prisoners out of the prison camps and made a march about 600 miles back into Germany. And this was in January and February of 45. Oh my, he told me about that, and that turned out to be equal to the Bataan Death March. But you don't hear much about it. But I know two of the guys that are still living today that were in that march, and they don't like to talk about it because they had to eat grass and insects and sleep in a barn or sleep together to keep warm a little bit. And my nose gunner was one of them. And I never got him to tell me, but I got this word from somebody else. But that was a horrible time they went through. The Germans was marching them, and they were suffering about as much as American prisoners were. But they didn't treat the Americans bad. I mean, the Germans didn't. But there's a lot of incidents there. And anyway, I came back to the squadron area sometime in August, I think it was, 1st of August, and it recuperated, and I started flying again. I flew 3 more missions, and I forget where they were now. But anyway, I flew with a lieutenant that's living today, and he's the preacher of our whole bomb group. Lives in Parkersburg, West Virginia. And he preaches each year at our services, memorial services, at wherever we're meeting. And he's missed the last 2. And he's deputized me to do the memorial service. And I'm not a preacher. But anyway, let's see. Oh, another one of my friends, on August the 30th of 44, one of our planes was in the group over Bucharest, Hungary, I think. Bucharest.
Budapest,
Hungary. Yeah. And they were bombing either an oil refinery or bombing the railroad yards. But they, right over the target, they got a direct hit in the bomb bay, a 88-millimeter shell. This one, 3 parachutes got out, and all the rest of them got blown to pieces. And one of them was their radio man that was one of my dearest friends. He was from West Homestead, Pennsylvania. I'll never forget him. He'd been with me, I forget how many months now. I mean, back to radio school, gunnery school, refresher, and training. But anyway, he got killed, and one of the crew members, we had a reunion in Pittsburgh, and one of the other crew members of that crew came to that reunion, and my mouth just dropped open. I said, "Espy Spencer, is that you?" He said, "I was one of them 3 parachutes." Oh, man, that was good. Man, it's something to talk to somebody like that that's been through experiences.
You thought he was dead.
I thought he was dead. I just, when I looked at him, I said, "You just can't be you. You're gone." And then his navigator was another one that got out, and I've seen him 2 or 3 times at reunions. It's something to see some people that you thought were dead and see the planes get blown out of the air. And we bombed back to some of the bombing runs. I don't know if you've ever heard of Ploiești, Romania, but they furnished about a third or maybe more of the oil, motor oil, for all of Hitler's armies and Air Force and everything. And so it was one of the biggest targets that we had. I've been over it 2 or 3 times, I forget. But they had nearly 200 anti-aircraft guns circled around that refinery. And every time we went over it, they had already put smoke pots all the way around that whole refinery. They had a whole section of the earth covered with smoke down there. We couldn't see the target. And we'd bomb it, and we could tell when it hit the refinery because the black smoke had come up through that white smoke. We knew the smoke pots. And anyway, that was we hated to go over that target because it was really well defended. And they always had fighters. Germans always had their fighters down there, too. But the first bomb run over that target was made in 42 or 40, early 43, I forget which. And General Artery that lives here in town, he was one of the leaders in that. But they went in at treetop level. Now, I forget how many bombers they sent over that day, but they lost 50% of the bombers.
It's a suicide mission.
And they've got pictures of videos of that flight, and you see some planes diving into the ground. You know all of them are gone, and some of them blown out of the air. It's to the other branches of service, the infantry guys, they had it the roughest. We'll admit that anytime, because they had to live with it day after day, 24 hours a day. But we flew in and come back out, you know, and that made a difference there. We respected the infantry, field artillery, and all the engineers and everybody. In order to boost the morale of the ground forces, we used to fly straight up Italy till we got to the fighting line. Then we'd turn and go out the Adriatic or the Mediterranean and then go on to target, just so the guys on the ground could see us, let them know we were supporting them. And I guess that was a kind of a morale booster for them. But then, that's the end of August is when I started my famous career, my career that was really something. My first sergeant came up to the squadron area when I flew those last three missions. He said, "How would you like to fly for a general?" I said, "Well, who wouldn't?" He said, "Well, you stay close to the squadron area." He said, "We've put your name in. There's a general up in France that needs a radio operator." So it went on for about almost 2 weeks. And I thought, well, they put a radio man's name in from every other squadron bomb group in Italy. I'll never get it. But one day that first sergeant come up, he said, "Martin, get your bags, here we go." And a captain and a major, and I don't know, two or three lieutenants, there's about five of them, took one of them 24s and flew this little old tech sergeant from Venosa up to Naples. We landed at Capitacino Airport, and I had to go across the airport to get on a plane that was four-star General Jacob L. Devers' plane. He was going to France, and I hitched a ride with him. Four-star general is a pretty important person. Anyway, we flew into Saint-Tropez, France. Saint-Tropez was T-R-O-P-E-Z or something like that. Anyway, that wasn't far from where we had bombed about a month earlier when the southern invasion of France went about. I was on that bombing run. And anyway, we landed there. And the front, the Americans and French and everybody, the English were pushing pretty fast. Patton, as you know, was really going through Europe. And so I don't know how long we stayed in Saint-Tropez. Then we moved up to the third largest city in France, Lyon, right up on the Rhone River. And then we stayed there a while. I don't remember any spectacular. Well, yeah, I think it was while we were in Lyon. We were always complaining about our food, but the officers, man, they got real good food. We had to take the plane's seats out, and there was about, I don't know how many, that C-53, it's just like a C-47. It'll seat about 30, 40 people, something like that. We took all the seats out and flew to Casablanca, North Africa, and got a plane load of eggs for the officer's mess. And we didn't get one of them.
Oh, no.
They went down. Anyway, and then one time again, we flew to Cognac, France, and got a whole load of liquor. Cognac and schnapps or whatever the other stuff was. I didn't drink. And flew that back to our outfits, and that officer's got all of that.
What were you all eating in your mess just, hall?
It wasn't quite that nice. We eat beans, peeled potatoes and eat them. And, well, they had some pretty good food. It did. But the Air Force and the Navy were the best feeding branches of service. I've visited a lot of different. I've visited Marines and Coast Guard and infantry and places, and they don't have quite as good a food as the Air Force and the Navy. Navy's got the best, had the best. And so we flew up to, went to Lyon, and I can't remember some of my dates back then. But from from Lyon, we moved to up about 30 miles from Epinal. And Epinal is over in the east section of France, and it's not too far from the German line, Stuttgart. And we were in a little town, a resort town of Vittel, Vittel, France. And all it was casinos and resort hotels and everything. And we were stationed in a hotel. And this is the time, right about the time of the Bulge, the Battle of the Bulge. And we got a big part of that snow down there, too. It was, I can't think, it was in December. But we couldn't fly, and nobody else around there could. And when that Bulge first started, why, I think they kind of alerted us that we were a big headquarters outfit then, and that we might have to move if the Germans turned south, you know, but they turned north instead. We didn't have to move. But we couldn't do anything with the snow 3 foot deep, but except get my first experience at snow skiing, and I didn't realize there's so many different ways you can fall on a pair of skis. But the front then, after the Battle of the Bulge, the front moved on in toward Germany, and then they crossed. And I think the next move was we made was after the forces had already taken Germany, most of Germany. But we flew into Heidelberg, and that's in the western part of Germany. And by the way, it's got the oldest university in Europe, Heidelberg University, and that's where they put our headquarters. And we had the English there. Ali Khan was there. You remember that Indian, Ali Khan, the Khan family, the richest rulers in India? Well, he was there. He was a playboy. Mm. And then one of the Vanderbilt persons was there. That's a big moneyed family in New York. And then General Devers was the commanding general. He was 4-star. And I was flying for his chief of staff, who was a major general. And anybody that wanted a plane, all they had to do was call General Barr, my general. And we flew for everybody. Flew like we went and got those eggs at cognac liquor from Cognac, France. We met Mr. and Mrs. Martel that owned that Martel cognac. And then we'd fly for parts, our airplane parts or different things. And also at this headquarters group was a group of 15 or 20 small planes that would fly the field officers up to the front as close as they could get to the Patton or what's their names? I can't think of the generals' names of the other armies. But on the southern part of the front was the French First Army, and then our Seventh Army, that was General Devers' command. And then above him was Patton, and then I forget the others on up north, but the English were clear to the northern part of Europe. And some of those little pilots that were they were enlisted men, they had trouble keeping up with Patton. They couldn't, he was moving. But anyway, I got to know most every one of those pilots, and they let me fly them little L-4 and L-5 planes.
Oh, had you ever piloted before? Or?
No, they were teaching me, you know, showing me how to, and I went out to Mannheim at that airport, and the guy that was the pilot, he got in the back seat, and he let me have the front seat, and I started shooting landings, just get down and touch the ground, and then hit the throttle and go around again. come in, shoot, land, and get me practice at that. That was real interesting. I love that.
Now, did you ever have to fly to the front?
No, I didn't. They wouldn't let it. They'd be, there's two places, two cockpit seats, you know, and that
small.
Whoever they were taking to the front is just one other, and that was a pilot. But they were all master and tech sergeants, and none of them were officers, and they were good friends. But their little airstrip was outside of Heidelberg, just at the edge of town, because they don't need a lot of space. They can take off out of a potato patch almost. But anyway, there was a German home right close to that airfield. And they were, I was out that airfield whenever I wasn't flying for the general. We were out there all the time. This German home would just happen to have two nice, pretty-looking girls. And me and another guy, we weren't allowed to talk to Germans even then. We weren't allowed to fraternize. We had to kind of hide to get up to see them. And we'd have to go through the orchard shrubs. And but anyway, they were friends. And one of the girls that I was seeing, Leah Moser was her name, she could speak a little English. And she'd studied some in high school. Her sister was named Beta. She couldn't speak a bit of English. But Leah, that my friend, could play the piano, and she liked music, and she knew quite a few American songs. And one she knew, "You Are My Sunshine." And every time we came out there, she made me sing that song to their mother was there, but their dad wasn't. He was in the Reichstag in the German army, in the way up north somewhere. Mm-hmm. But I had to sing that. I had learned the tenor a little bit of that, and me and this other guy, and we'd sing that. They gave me a birthday party for my 21st birthday. And I got a picture of the house here, and the lady, her family owned the house, but my Moser family was just renters. And they baked me a gooseberry pie, and the only thing was lacking was sugar. They couldn't get any sugar at all. It was a little bitter, but boy, I ate that like it was caviar. But that they were real nice to me, and I was surprised that most of all the Germans, when we were started allowed to talk to them, they weren't mad at us, and they could have been, because all this, a few of them that hollered about the bombs we used to drop, said, "You go, people tear up everything around here." But they never took their anger out on us, and this German family treated me real nice. And I was there when their dad came home from the army. And I found out from Leah that he didn't like the idea of two American soldiers seeing his daughters. But she says,
not while he was off at the front fighting you guys.
Yeah. But she says, "You don't have to worry. Dad ain't going to stop us." So anyway, this family was so nice to me. And even after I left, we corresponded for several years. And then three years ago now, I guess it is, my niece up in Ohio and her husband, he was in the Air Force. They went stationed at Heidelberg. And I had them to go visit this house and tell her. So my other niece went with her. And I got pictures of them in Heidelberg with this lady that owned the house. And she told them about giving me the birthday party and the beautiful rose bush at the side of their house. And that was a wonderful experience. I felt sorry for the German people, but not the Nazis, not the Hitler and his bunch, but them German people. Leah one time told me she just knew the Russians treated the Germans better than the Americans did. I said, "Well, why don't you just move over in the Russian zone?" "Oh, no, no." But anyway, I was surprised at that treatment we received from the German people. And I remember when our officers or some of the people from intelligence would put pictures of the death camps, those concentration camps, put them in the store windows down and with all them dead bodies, and boy, them Germans used to, they'd look at that and make a face and get away from it right quick. They didn't, some of them didn't believe it, but it happened. I never saw any of those death camps, and never got to, I wasn't far from one or two, but I didn't get a chance to go by. And I had a wonderful time in that Heidelberg, and I learned to kayak. I found a little kayak, and boy, I loved it. And one of the other generals there had a crew that were flying a B-25 bomber, that medium bomber. And I flew with them a time or two and went down to Lake Constance, where Friedrichshafen, right across the lake from Switzerland. This pilot went down to see his girlfriend, and I'd fly with him, fly up in the nose. And he'd notify his girlfriend that he was there by going down and buzzing the town. When he come out of that down there, well, there's mountains right in front of him. And man, I began to wonder if he's going to get above them trees. Anyway, he flew us down there two or three times. We had a great time. And then in April, this is before I went into Germany, I think it was. Yeah. We were told to go down to Stuttgart. And we flew down there, and the officers probably knew, but I didn't know who we were going to pick up. But we picked up two men that had been prisoners of war, and one of them was Ambassador Winant's son, our ambassador to England. I think that's who, and the other one was Queen Elizabeth's nephew. And that was just before this queen made queen. She was still princess then. But anyway, we picked them up and took them to London. We flew them right into Heathrow Airport. And when we landed, why, I could see the queen mother. The queen was over there at a place. But we let them in out at a different spot. I don't guess they wanted us to pull up in front of all the queen and all her entourage. But anyway, I told my pilot, I said, hey, I want to go over and meet the queen. He said, get in the plane, Sergeant. We're going back to France. I was in a dip.
Well, but, I'm going to take a moment here, and I'm gonna pause this, and we're going to pick this up on another date here.
Another date?
Yes, just a moment.